Welcome to the second of our two special episodes in Work Now and in the Future Tools for Thinking podcast series. Our guest today is Professor Alessandro Del Fanti from University of Toronto. His research explores work within digital capitalism, digital countercultures, and emerging forms of resistance and refusal. In this episode, he will discuss his book, The Warehouse, Workers and Robots at Amazon. For additional materials and resources, visit www.aalto.fi/fi/futurework and navigate to the podcast section. Now, without further ado, let's welcome Professor Alessandro Del Fanti.
First of all, thank you for inviting me. So thank you, Herbert. Thank you, Elena, also for organizing this and for inviting me and for your interest in my work. So I'm just going to talk about this book that came out at this point a couple of years ago, titled The Warehouse, Workers and Robots at Amazon. This is something I wrote while working at the University of Toronto as a professor, but the research is actually based in my old country, Italy. So in a minute, we'll talk about that a little bit, about the place where I conducted this research. So the sort of like starting point for this idea of researching Amazon was that we tend to experience these company as consumers, the majority of us. And I really wanted to change that and look at what happens behind the curtain between our click on an order and the delivery of a package to our doorsteps. So I was really interested in this sort of hidden abode of digital work that when I started researching this book was still pretty much opaque. I think in the last few years, we've seen a deluge of journalists and researchers and workers also directly sort of exposing the reality of what happens in the facilities where this company stores the commodities it sells and then distributes them to the consumers. So I really wanted to apply a labor focus to this massive company. I'm going to quickly discuss three of the sort of main ideas that or main sort of like theoretical concepts that is sort of developed out of this empirical research that I did in the warehouse. These are the idea of machinic dispossession, the idea of augmented despotism, and then the idea of humans extending automation. So we'll talk about all these three sort of concepts in a minute. So I wanted to start by making sure we are on the same page here in terms of understanding that Amazon is part of a larger trend of the application of digital technologies to the labor process. So there are other platforms, digital capitalism companies that pretty much follow similar logics in terms of the way in which they use digital technology, use new forms of automation to reorganize the labor process. So I just wanted to argue that Amazon is not a unique case. Although what makes it interesting is the size of this company. So we're talking about one of the largest private employers, if not the largest private employer in the world, a network of 200 and counting FCs or fulfillment centers, so the massive warehouses where most of the commodities are stored, plus thousands and thousands of smaller distribution centers. So very interesting from the viewpoint of the number of people that work for this company, also the technological firepower of this company in terms of investments in developing or acquiring new technology that then they use inside the warehouse to organize the labor of managing inventory, managing our orders. A very interesting place to look at the way in which to use Ruha Benjamin's, to borrow an idea from American Black technology scholar Ruha Benjamin, a very good place to look at how technology is used to innovate inequity. So to reproduce unjust relationships of power in the workplace. I'm also I also need to say that while I focus on the warehouse because I think it's one of the core places where you can actually study the evolution of labor in our era, Amazon is much more than that. So it would be a mistake to sort of reduce Amazon to its e-commerce operations. Amazon is a much larger company. A lot of us know this very well. So at the very least, we should mention Amazon Web Services, the largest provider of connectivity and computation in the world. Amazon as an increasing role as a cultural industry. So with its TV, music, and so on and so forth, and then devices like the Kindle. There is an entire and consumer devices like Alexa and other devices. So Amazon is much more than e-commerce, and all these branches of this company are somehow related to each other. So it's analytically one can separate the warehouse from the rest of this company, but it's we need to be aware that this is it's an epistemic move that we need to take in order to focus on one thing. You can actually analyze empirically, but it will, we have to keep in mind that Amazon is much larger than this. And for instance, its computational power is directly used to organize e-commerce operations of the company. So, like I said, hundreds of massive fulfillment centers where the commodities are stored. I just wanted to give you a sense of the geography of these places. They tend to be located around major metropolitan centers, especially in Europe and North America, but expanding to Asia and South America currently. So, for instance, in Toronto, there are several fulfillment centers that all are located in the outskirts of downtown, where the bulk of the customers reside. But the workforce well, there are logistical reasons why fulfillment centers are at the periphery of major metropolitan centers, so easier to move commodities there via train or truck, but also because of the workforce that is needed to staff these places. So each fulfillment center may employ up to 5,000-6,000 people. In many cases, there's a core group of full-time workers, and then a mass of temp workers hired especially through temp agencies that are used to expand and contract the workforce at will, depending on the needs of consumption. So, for instance, around peaks like Prime Day or Christmas, Amazon will hire thousands of temp workers to staff its warehouses, thus expanding the workforce. What's interesting is that the geographical location of these places is used again to sort of tap into massive workforces that are available conduct the labor that's necessary for Amazon to exist in the first place. And these workers tend to be located in the peripheries of our major metropolitan centers, and they tend to be people of color or migrant populations that have increasingly been hired by Amazon. Pretty much, it's a similar pattern across the world in a sense. So we'll talk about this labor composition maybe later too. So my own research, though, was not based in Toronto, where I live and where I work, but in my old hometown of Piacenza in northern Italy. So there's some serendipity here in my choice to work on this company. So I think I realized that just around the corner from my hometown, there was this massive fulfillment center, MXP5, which I'm going to show right here, which has been operating near Piacenza since 2011, I want to say. The first and still the largest fulfillment center in the country. So strategically located in a place, my hometown, that lays right at the center of the Po Valley in northern Italy, and especially suited to serve Milan, the largest market, especially at the time, for Amazon. So I basically found in my hometown this very interesting advanced place that one could use as a laboratory to study the evolution of labor, the digital era. And because of the sheer size of it, I literally had all the classmates and friends and people and, you know, acquaintances working there. So I had privileged access to this place because of the people who worked there. But also I had been discussing this place in terms of the politics of labor at this company ever since it first moved to my hometown. So interestingly, before we from this place could actually order from Amazon, we could work that. So at the beginning, the orders would only go into Milan, but people from Piacenza were already working there. I decided to again focus on this place, and what I did was to for several years to conduct empirical research through site visits. So I visited this and several other fulfillment centers in Europe and North America several times. But most importantly, I interviewed workers, especially from this fulfillment center, but also from other fulfillment centers in, again, both in Europe and North America. I ran analysis of the online conversations that Amazon workers have, so on platforms where they share ideas, suggestions, tips, or political content, and so on and so forth, around their work in the fulfillment center. I also tried to study these companies' corporate culture, so by going to events organized by the company, collecting PR material, and so on and so forth. And last but not least, I also studied the patents that this company owns for technology that would be introduced in the warehouse in the future. So we'll talk about that again later. So this is the inside of one major fulfillment center. So the central area is called the Peak Tower, which is a multi-story inventory of several stories. And then lined with shelves containing billions and billions of commodities that Amazon sells. This is where in the book I talk about this as a laboratory to study the encounter between workers and automation in the current age. I really think it's a very interesting place to study some of the dynamics that we'll discuss in a minute. I approached it through my background in media studies and science and technology studies, so looking at the materiality of technology and how that interacts with humans. But also I came in with this, using this tradition of autonomist labor studies, so typical Italian tradition of Marxist analysis developed since the 60s that looks at workers as the main agents of change within capitalism. So the power of leading labor sort of taking over the power of management or the power of technology. So I also studied the corporate culture of this company. So I looked at the cultures of work more in general, once say within Amazon warehouses. So starting from the main slogan, one of many slogans that you will see painted inside the warehouse. This is one of the most famous ones: work hard, have fun, make history. You'll find it again painted on the walls in massive font at MXP5, the warehouse I studied. It's actually you encounter it as soon as you walk into the warehouse. I follow these slogans to organize the book. So the chapters are actually called "Work Hard, Have Fun, Make History," and then other slogans like "Relentless" "Customer Obsession." What I found interesting, I'm using this slogan to just like highlight the way in which the warehouse, Amazon warehouses, can be seen as a laboratory, both from the technological viewpoint, but also from the political and ideological viewpoint. So the study of the cultures of work within Amazon helped me look at the second two, the political and ideological sort of ways in which these warehouses can be seen as laboratories for the transformations of labor that we're witnessing in these last few years. So the work hard part is easy to understand. It's physical, repetitive labor, very high turnover, very high rate of injuries, This is no big news if anyone has followed even just the news media around Amazon, especially since 2017, 2018, when the first strikes happened at the company. It's very clear that this is it's heavy, demanding work. People don't last a long time in these places. There's a very high turnover. It's the work hard part tend to be involved within the slogan that we discussed first. It's one of the most important sort of messages that workers get as soon as they walk into the warehouse. So this culture of speed and willingness to abide by the rhythms and the pace dictated by consumption. So it's interesting here because like this the mass scale, so the sheer number of workers, for instance, for MXP5, we're talking about 1,500 full-time. This number may double during peaks. So the number of workers, the pace of work, the physical nature of the job, really sort of in this high-tech environment, really show really a testament to the idea that, well, Marx actually wrote in Capital 150 years ago that when he said that machines, rather than destroying jobs, machines create new incentives to the insatiable appetite for the labor of others that capital has. So rather than replacing living labor, machinery as used in Amazon warehouses and elsewhere, tend to, if anything, increase the capital's appetite for living labor. Just to explain how the labor process very quickly, the main instrument of labor is a barcode scanner. This can take the place of a handheld scanner, pretty much like the ones you see in a supermarket, the cashier. Or it could be a wearable technology that incorporates barcode scanners and so on and so forth. But the point is that workers, what they do is they log into the system. So for instance, what they do at MXP5, they walk into the warehouse, grab a scanner, shoot their own or scan their own badge that logs them into the system, coupling them with the scanner they're using. So from that moment on, the scanner both dictates the labor process, giving them instructions on what to do, and also collects data, like a variety of data from their labor. So the labor of the picker, the workers tasked with retrieving commodities that have been ordered and then sending them to shipment, is organized through the barcode scanner in a very simple way, I want to say. So very similar to what happens in a gig economy app like Foodora or Uber or Deliveroo. So it's just instead of a phone app, it's a digital scanner with a screen with instructions on what to retrieve and where it is. So go to second floor, shelf number 5, cell K73, and retrieve these wireless headphones that someone has ordered. So the worker walks there, scans the item, scans the cart they are carrying around, puts the item in the cart. At this point, the system knows that the wireless headphones have been picked and they're going to pack to packaging and then shipping. So in a sense, very simple process. What's interesting is that as the scanner organizes labor, dictating the tasks to individual pickers, it also collects information on that. So so the scanner is a technology workers have to use. In fulfillment center, it's also technology that makes them fully transparent or partially transparent to management, in that it collects all sorts of data, especially on their rates, their productivity, the speed of their labor. So how many pieces picked per hour? So while the tasks may be assigned automatically by the inventory software running the fulfillment center, what's interesting is that the data coming from the scanner are also fed to the human managers that on the shop floor control the workforce and push them to abide by the rhythms dictated by machinery and by consumption if you want to go upstream. So the system of surveillance is not limited to the scanner. So there is also, for instance, AI-powered cameras that make sure that people behave in certain manners within the warehouse. It's one of the most surveilled workplaces on earth. There's a system of body scanners that people have to go through when they enter and when they leave the fulfillment center. So digital technology is widely deployed in this and other similar warehouses to not only to organize the labor process, but also to control and monitor the workforce. So the easiest example would be a message popping up on a picker's screen saying, go to the team leader's position for one-to-one, which means that the team leader or the manager will inform the workers that, for instance, their pace is too slow, so they have to pick up speed if they want to, for instance, be renewed in their job down the line if they are hired by a temp agency. So I call this augmented despotism, in that I see technology as an extension of a very human form of power, managerial power that's at place in workplaces, regardless of the technological organization of labor. So here I went back to the early autonomous thinkers, such as, for instance, Raniero Panzieri. Early 60s, he was analyzing the introduction of new emerging technology in the shop floor. In that case, that was the assembly line back in the day in industrial in the factories of industrial capitalism of mid 20th century industrial capitalism, and Panzieri wrote that you can't possibly separate the technologies used to organize labor, the techniques, so the managerial techniques used to organize and control labor, and then the despotism, the imbalance of power that's always at play in industrial capitalism. So a very interesting, very revealing call for me to go to look beyond the technological layer and look at how human power gets to be augmented or strengthened by the application of digital technology to the labor process. Stowing is the opposite of picking. So these are the stowers or the workers who fill the warehouse with the commodities. So imagine a truck is unloaded, the boxes, the pallets, and then the boxes are open. Workers, the commodities are put in carts, and workers walk with these carts inside the pick tower to sort of position items on the shelves. So what's interesting here is that the system that Amazon and other similar companies use to organize the inventory allows them to maintain a full monopoly of the knowledge of where the stuff is in the warehouse. So just to explain the process, like it's based on what they call chaotic storage or pseudo-random forms of storage. Whereas there is no specific area of the warehouse for a certain kind of item. So there is no shelf that's dedicated to, let's say, wireless headphones. But single copies of the same item are spread throughout the pick tower. So the workers, and this is for efficiency reasons. You can use space more efficiently if you can squeeze something in any cell, regardless of whether that's the, because there is no specific area for wireless headphones, you can squeeze them wherever they fit. And also, if you spread your copies of your items all across like a massive warehouse, it's going to be much more likely that any area of the warehouse would have at least a copy of this item. So any picker working in a certain area of this massive pick tower will be able to find a copy of those wireless headphones near them. So it speeds up the labor of retrieving the commodities later, assigning commodities to pickers in different areas of the warehouse. But while the picking is automated, in that the decisions about what to pick and who's to pick it is outsourced to algorithms, stowing is much more reliant on human embodied creativity. So the stowers have to walk around and find ways to efficiently store items in these like small cells. So find wherever there is room for one, make sure they're divided, they're far enough from each other, and so on and so forth. So this creates this chaotic or pseudo-randomized form of inventory, which is impossible to know for any human being, including managers. So the knowledge about the geography of the warehouse or where the stuff is fully incorporated in the software systems that run the inventory. So once a store has stored an item on the shelves, there is no way for them and or for managers to actually find out where that is. So that's completely outsourced to algorithms. And this gives Amazon a complete monopoly over this typical traditional form of knowledge that warehouse workers used to have. So in my interviews, for instance, Amazon workers who had previous experience working in traditional warehouses would actually stress this as a form of dispossession. So I was the system takes away from me the knowledge that in a traditional kind of warehouse, you will build over time about where the stuff is, and that will make you a more efficient worker, of course. That's now completely outsourced to machines. It's impossible for us to know that. And they saw that as the loss of a form of political leverage that they had with the company. So what they call the machinic dispossession, the incorporation of the knowledge about where something is in the warehouse, into software systems makes Amazon workers more easily replaceable because they've been taken away the knowledge of where the commodities are, and thus it's much more easy to just replace that with someone who just needs to follow the instructions on the scanner to retrieve the next commodity. So Amazon is one of the largest R&D players in the world, one of the largest private R&D players in the world. They deposit hundreds of patents every year. It's very interesting material that has to do with the future of the warehouse in a sense, because these are the documents where the lawyers and the engineers who work for Amazon inscribe the way in which they imagine new technologies that may actually enter the warehouse in the future. It's very rich material because the patents include very thorough descriptions and designs of a new invention as per patent lingo. They're also very good documents to look at the ways in which futures can be owned by private interest, to borrow an idea from the late sociologist John Urry. They can also be problematic because you cannot take for granted that what you find in a patent will actually materialize in the future. Sometimes they're only used to prevent competition from moving into certain new technological areas, so on and so forth. But in the book I argue that they're very good materials to look, if not at the future of work, at least at the ways in which capital desires the future of work. So again, we went and studied hundreds of these objects, and some are clearly. We did a textual analysis, so we actually read them, trying to figure out which future of work was inscribed in these documents. So some are pretty much unrealistic. So there is some, for instance, for flying fulfillment centers that can float over an area where there's a concentration of customers, let's say a stadium where there's a football game going on, and then a fleet of drones will fly down to the stadium to deliver whatever the customers have ordered, team jerseys and popcorn, I guess. Automated docks where the drones can be loaded inside the floating fulfillment center. This is one of the most sort of imaginative ones. Very unlikely it will materialize anytime in the near future or anytime at all. But then some are much more mundane. And the ones that are much more mundane tend to have to do with specific projects or desires for a certain kind of future of work inside the warehouse. So there's a set, for instance, of technologies based on augmented reality. So imagine a worker wearing goggles with AI-powered cameras mounted on them. So as you're working inside the fulfillment center, the goggles project on top of your natural field of vision arrows. They will tell you where to turn. So turn left in the next aisle. So this has to do with speeding up labor, optimizing human labor rather than replacing human labor. So again, in the service of the rhythms dictated by consumption. So technology mediated between consumption and labor by speeding up labor. in the service of consumption. So the very same technology can be used to foster forms of what I called earlier augmented despotism. So imagine a supervisor wearing augmented reality goggles, and when they look at a worker, the system projects on top of their natural field of vision information on the worker, so that the AI-powered cameras recognize, so there is face recognition technology, they recognize the worker, and then they project on top of the supervisor's field of vision information on this worker, what their task is, where they've been complaining, how efficient they are, why they requested your assistance, for instance. So this is a form of, again, I think this technology will foster what I call augmented despotism by making workers even more transparent to management through the application of digital technology in the workplace. A lot of patents have to do with what they call humanly extended automation. So imagining humans as the carriers of sensors that generate valuable information for the software systems that run the inventory in a warehouse. So for instance, again, glasses that capture 3D information from a cell to inform the system about which kind of object could actually fit in there, or these sort of like digital Taylorism processes, whereas workers perform tasks, for instance, grab a mug while wearing gloves that capture information about the speed, pressure, movement of their hand, and then feed that information to a computer system that will use it to improve the operations of machining robotic arms that could actually replace the worker conducting the performing the task. So I call these forms of sensing for the machine a human extended automation. This is where I'm sort of flipping here Marshall McLuhan's traditional take on media extending humans. So in this case, I'm saying that humans extend the machinery's ability to sense the environment and act upon the environment, but they become these sort of, to go back to Marx's words, they sort of become, they put workers in a position where they become the appendices of machinery. So this is what I call humanly extended automation. And just to wrap this up, what the sort of general take from the patents I analyzed is that Amazon, pretty much like other similar companies, is very explicit in terms of acknowledging the continuing need for human labor in the workplace, even in the future. So we found quotes in some of these patents that could pretty much come from a sociology of labor textbook. So for instance, there is one here that says, quote, automation is expensive and time-consuming to implement, unlike a human workforce, which can be allocated according to need, unquote. So basically here, the engineers and lawyers working for Amazon are saying, well, automation is pretty cool, but humans are cheaper and more flexible. So we plan to use humans in the warehouse for the foreseeable future. So it's a signal of the ways in which digital capital, again, imagines using machinery to whet its appetite for living labor, but not to replace the presence of human labor in its workplaces. So this is another way in which Amazon, to me, is a laboratory. So this is one of the most advanced workplaces in the world in terms of the sort of like algorithmic and robotic technologies that they deploy in the warehouse. But then this sort of transparency when they say, but we will always need humans. We will need even more humans maybe in the future. So kind of running against the grain of concerns about digital technology, especially robotics, replacing human labor.
Yes, thank you for joining us today. And can you kind of elaborate a little bit about the managerial culture? Because I'm very interested in the basically like what you were saying here in the end, that the human is kind of like, you said, appendix to the machinery, if you like, the machines, and echoing this kind of idea that instead of the machines bringing more freedom to us and letting us become, I don't know, creative and fulfilling ourselves and doing the dull tasks, this is the other way trend. And this is like further exploitation, if you like, with the help of algorithms. So what about the managerial culture? How are the managers? Would you elaborate a little bit about that? Because you left it out now in the interest of time.
The local managerial cultures change dramatically from country to country and even from fulfillment center to fulfillment center. But there is a certain, as multinational corporations do, there is an umbrella sort of managerial culture that's imposed from above onto the various fulfillment centers. So the problem that Amazon has is that this is a manual, repetitive, physical, even dangerous labor that has to be performed very quickly, and workers have to be ready to change their pace and adapt to the rhythms of consumption as dictated by the machine at any given moment. So there is a clash here between the workers' interest in, you know, just like taking it easy, and that the companies need to speed up both the pace of work and also the pace at which it can replace people in the warehouse to sort of like, you know, introduce new bodies in the process. So the despotic nature of management is definitely there. So you can be, you know, your people are surveilled very strictly. They can suffer consequences if they do not abide by the rhythms of, again, dictated the machinery. This is being unveiled over and over again, especially by workers themselves during strikes and mobilizations, but also by journalists. But this more despotic side is not the only weapon that Amazon deploys to make sure the workers actually do follow the rhythms dictated by the machinery. So the other one is a more ideological push towards building consent regarding these rhythms. So Amazon has adopted a set of managerial techniques that are used to sort of like project the company's ideology onto the workforce. Nothing super original, but what's interesting is the how many Amazon deploys and the combination between this and the despotic side. So the main thing is that Amazon is supposed to be a fun place to work. So there is something about Amazon exceptionalism where workers are told that working at Amazon is more fun, more interesting, more informal, and you should be happy that you work here. So and this is captured by the slogans that covered the warehouse's walls, the sort of like colorful nature of the fulfillment center itself, that basically, especially in the break rooms and the canteen, mimics Silicon Valley campuses like Google's. So colorful, playful, with, you know, tennis table and video games in the canteen and so on and so forth. And then these briefings or stand-ups in the States where for 5 minutes at the beginning of each shift when you go back to work after your lunch break, the team leader will get all the workers of the team together and basically make them do some activity together that shows how much they abide by the culture of work there. So for instance, prizes for the teams that have been faster, or you can be asked to dance, or you can be asked to celebrate how many pieces you delivered yesterday or last night. So I called it a culture of mandatory fun, where these briefings have to be attended. And while you can pretend you like them, most people secretly not like them, but like they certainly are mandatory. And also there is technology also being used to sort of monitor your adherence to corporate culture. So the same barcode scanner you use to work will ask you questions like, how much do you like working at Amazon? And then there is a, you know, you can click on a lot, I love it, a little bit, or not at all. But you do this while you're logged into the system. So workers don't trust this post to be anonymous, although Amazon uses them to sort of reinforce the idea towards the external world to say, but we ask our workers all the time and they say they love us. So there is this like sort of enforced culture of positivity and fun that they deploy to sort of like counterbalance the material conditions of work.
That's a good way to get to our next question, which is that you said this during the presentation. This is that you call Amazon, you describe Amazon as a laboratory for algorithmic management. That they test out, the patents were very interesting, this kind of possible imagined futures from the perspective of lawyers and capitalists, I guess. So how do you see these systems shaping not only these experiences of workers, which are, you talked quite a lot about, but also the broader, our understanding of labor, work?
On the one hand, there is, I guess, a more sort of technical organizational answer, which is that Amazon is at the forefront of innovating technology to be used in these kind of workplaces, and other companies are following suit. So Amazon is ahead of the competition in the e-commerce or in the warehousing industry in terms of developing and deploying the new technology, and other companies will try and either copy what Amazon does or purchase technologies that will be similar to those that Amazon uses. In certain cases, even hiring people from Amazon to staff e-commerce warehouses that basically mimic the organizational design that Amazon has. So I've seen other e-commerce warehouses in the same area, but also elsewhere, where the managers and the team leaders are all hired out of Amazon. The processes are very similar. They're just behind in terms of deploying more technology in the warehouse. So this is a very technical sort of point. It's a laboratory because of this ability to develop and deploy new technologies quickly, and the others sort of following suit, with the exception of big Chinese e-commerce companies that are the only actors that are able to compete with Amazon at this point from that viewpoint at least. There is also a more political point, maybe, which is that Amazon is pushing this model of employment that has this, especially this very high turnover and this very ideological side, whereas there is a promise of economic and social emancipation to the workers who participate in Amazon. But then there is also the sort of harsh reality of the material conditions. So these, especially not just the physical nature or the fact that you have to be ready to abide by whatever request in terms of changing shifts or working or doing overtime or speeding up the pace of labor, but also the very high turnover. So we know that there is data from certain areas, especially in the States, that say that Amazon has a 200% turnover rate, which basically means that for each job, on average, the worker staffing a certain position is replaced twice in a year on average. So I think there's this more political point about how Amazon is a laboratory for the politics of labor in terms of imposing a more precarious kind of labor, imposing harsh anti-union politics. So that's certainly more concerning. But what's interesting is also that the workers have been fighting back, especially in the last few years. We have all read about the strikes. One of the very first strikes was at MXP5, the warehouse in my hometown. So it's also a laboratory for worker struggles. Maybe we can talk about this later. But
yeah, well, actually, my next question is coming to that. So maybe you can expand on that, because basically I'm asking, or someone's asking, that that you talk about the tyranny of algorithms, that how do you view the potential for workers or even societies? As you said, this will be spreading, this way of working and thinking and managing. What are the possibilities to break free from this system? And can you give examples of resistance or alternatives that inspire you?
Yeah, it's been very interesting to see the ways in which workers subvert the technological organization of the warehouse. We can start from very small acts of micro sabotage, for instance, the worker who is aware of these random or chaotic nature of inventory and thus willfully misplaces an item, and because it's not immediately visible that an item is not in the correct area of the warehouse, because the warehouse is an organized mess or chaos, that item is lost for, can be lost forever, at least for a long time. So for instance, I've heard workers saying, well, I know how the system, how this chaotic storage system works. So I know I can sort of screw with it and take my little revenge. But then there is also like higher level ways in which workers have imagined how to subvert Amazon. So for instance, finding the choke points in the, in Amazon's and other companies' value chains. A single FC doesn't mean much to Amazon. You should see them as a network of warehouses that will all work together. So if you stop one, any order can be rerouted through a different fulfillment center. So Amazon is continuously deploying, you know, developing and deploying technology, algorithmic technologies that have to do with this ability to use flexibly a network of warehouses. So for instance, workers in Italy that have realized like how difficult it is to actually impact this model by with the traditional tactics like striking in one facility. A couple of years ago, they have, for instance, mobilized the entire value chain all the way from the cost centers to the fulfillment centers, the smaller warehouses, and the last mile delivery. And they found that last mile delivery is one of the choke points, so it's much more easier to organize workers to actually deliver for Amazon, and that can hurt the company much more so than what happens in an FC. So, for instance, there was a famous strike in and around Milan. Well, national, but in and around Milan, the day of the strike, over 200,000 packages were not delivered. I think that was the more or less ballpark the number. So, massive success in terms of strike, and that was achieved by figuring out first which kinds of workers would actually be more successful, and that was the delivery workers. So I think we're seeing interesting tactics being developed, and also very interesting coalitions internationally, nationally and internationally. So because it's a multinational company able to move around quickly across different regions of the world, but even globally, workers have been aware that you need to have an international, if not a global response. So there is like several, at this point, coalitions, global coalitions of workers and unions and other worker-led organizations that try to tackle Amazon at that level rather than at the level of the single facility.
Super interesting. But can we go to the next question that kind of links a bit like that? You talked about the surveillance methods and how the tool that you use is also a tracker. So could you elaborate a little bit about how the surveillance extends beyond productivity to influence the actual autonomy and dignity of the workers, like the fun, the enforced fun part? I think that's a highly interesting one.
Yeah. So, well, first of all, whatever technology you use to work, it will extract data from your productivity. So the very, again, like I said, the very basic processes like counting how many pieces you did per hour, and then the supervisor can tell you, well, you're not making right. But there is also the scanner also makes visible to management your breaks, for instance. So called the TOT, time off task, which means that you log off the scanner to go on lunch break or go to the bathroom. So famously leading to issues, especially at the beginning of the, you know, a few years ago when Amazon for the first time, because I kind of was put under the spotlight. That was one of the main sort of forms of control that was criticized, the fact that people, like the management, can see how many minutes they spend in the bathroom. But in terms of enforcing this, this corporate culture that we're discussing, again, one of the main ways I found is these polls that workers receive, whereas they are asked to confirm that they adhere to the corporate ideology of Amazon, including again just confirming that they like working there. But in this case, the scanner is one of the tools used. There are a lot of the tools that are used by management wait a second. There is another one that's mediated by digital technologies that's very important, which is these boards where people can suggest changes. So back in the day, it used to be in typical Kaizen modality, for those who are familiar with Japanese Toyotism models, people could suggest improvements. So just write down something on a piece of paper, post it on a board, and the management will be able to see that you suggested to change the ways in which the cars are moved around. And now all that has been digitized. So now workers are logged in when they make suggestions. So that's another way in which management can control a worker's willingness to actually spend time and energy suggesting things to the company. And that is, it's also taken away the possibility that workers use that sort of feedback mechanism to criticize the company, because it's been digitized and it's not. Although the company claims it's anonymous, it's not anymore. So I think this company, pretty much like other similar companies in digital capitalism, but also industrial capitalism, has deploys these technologies to make sure that people at least pretend they abide by the sort of corporate culture that they want to see in the workplace. I call this like enforced culture of fun or something like that.
But what do you think, like going forward, governments, unions, civil society organizations, what role should these instances play? How should we be addressing this developing capitalism, these developments of work? Like, instead of letting it just go on the Amazon's terms, which seems to be the current sort of a situation, then what should we do in your view?
I'm not sure I'm in a position to tell you what we should do. I can say that there is like different levels at which Amazon is being challenged. So one is the sort of like policy level where antitrust legislation may very well soon be used against Amazon. People say that they were pretty scared of the possibility that Kamala Harris would win in the States because she would have brought in the antitrust legislation to actually break down Amazon and other big tech companies. So I wonder if this, regardless of the outcome of the election, I wonder if in the States or the EU would actually step in and sort of break this like major monopoly at this point in several areas of our economy. Then, of course, there is like legislation being introduced, for instance, that applies renews the principles that protect workers' privacy in a digital era. So the laws we have can be updated in terms of like the new technologies that have been applied to the workplace in the last 10 or 20 years, especially in the EU. I guess there's a big push to changing or adapting some of the laws that we already have to sort of protect workers in these environments. And then at the level, same could be said at the national level for contracts. Labor politics in the different countries where Amazon operates and similar companies operates will determine the ways in which they can exploit, to the extent to which they can exploit workers, the wages they have to pay, and so on and so forth. So this is a sphere where it goes well beyond Amazon, of course. Mm. And then there is like the workers, the mobilization, so the worker organizations that are certainly taking up the fight at several levels. And again, like I said, there is even transnational networks organizing to improve the situation in this company. I think they've been successful in some countries. So, for instance, you said in 10 years, go back to the same fulfillment center. I think I did it in the last couple of years after the book came out, and they started researching it in 2017. But already in 21, 22, workers will tell me the situation had improved a little bit in terms of, for instance, the flexibility that's imposed on them in terms of accepting shifts or overtime. Mm-hmm. Just to give you one example. So I think workers have been successful in some countries, especially if nothing more, at least normalizing what happens in this place. And this is also part of wider struggles that have enveloped the warehousing industry in the last 10 years, at least. So Amazon is just one piece of the puzzle there.
Yeah.
I think like within the warehousing and logistics industry, there's a lot of exciting stuff happening right now in terms of workers' organizations, and I guess they will know better what's to be done.
Yeah, no, I'm just asking for you to sort of give your I feel. And there's the next question that we're kind of now just going to kind of skate over, but someone's asking that at what do you think are going to be the global impacts of Amazon's practices in terms of the labor solidarity of the global north versus global south? And I guess you're here highlighting that there's already some movements that, people are actually successfully working together to I don't know what would be the right word, adjust to this changing work in this way and kind of also demanding improvements. So it's good to hear that there's been some. I'm conscious of us being almost at the end of our time. So I'm going to make you again think about the future of work here, because like I'm thinking that one thing that I was thinking reading your work and now listening to you was that you often, people who are very enthusiastic about technology see a lot of possibility in it. And there's an argument by MIT researchers that we could, with these technologies, build a globally sustainable working life for everyone. And then the more dystopic views have been introduced as well. And somehow, I mean, I realized that your data consists of different experiences, but I also couldn't escape from the feeling of dystopia lurking around the corner, reading it and listening to you. So how do you, if you have to position yourself in terms of future work, are you an optimist, pessimist, or something in between, and why? How do you view this development of labor work, future technologies?
So I guess I'm a bit of a pessimist there in this meaning that, first of all, I'm not sure we can simply repurpose technologies imagined, designed, and built to exploit human labor.
Mm.
Difficult to repurpose those technologies to do something different. So maybe we'll have to reimagine the technologies we use to work, at least partially, to be able to actually use them in an autonomous way or in a progressive way that's not hurtful for our societies, our environment, and so on and so forth. So Amazon is an entire machine built to increase consumption and capture data and optimize labor. Very difficult to see how that can be repurposed towards something that would have a positive influence, for instance, on climate, the fight against climate change. And then politically, that's a more open question. Like right now, we're seeing the resurgence of fascism in the West, and not only. I mean, look at Russia, yeah. India, and you have it. What have you. And I don't see equally strong movements coming from labor right now challenging this resurgence of fascism. So it's unwritten, of course, but I'm concerned about what could happen to the labor movement in a situation where these far-right politicians actually take over even more so than they have so far, what that could lead us to.
Mm.
So those are the pessimistic, I guess, sides of this argument. I'm excited about the energy coming from the workers at Amazon and beyond, especially migrant labor, especially in Europe and North America, the places where I'm most familiar with. So that's exciting. I think there's a lot of energy there that could be released and maybe change things for the best, but it's still to be seen.
Well, thank you. Sadly, we don't have any more time, and we're very grateful for this hour that you've given us. So I don't want to push you any further and let you get on with your day there. But thank you very much for this. Thanks for coming to talk to us and answering some of the questions that we had time to pose.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The podcast is in collaboration with Aalto's Future Work Project, the Finnish Association of Work-Life Research, and the Work 2030 program.